Independence Day. And I feel particularly independent today because I'm happy to have in the studio with me Dr. Bill Armington. And we're going to be talking about various stuff. But first of all, Bill, I'd like to get you to do a little biographical sketch for me.
Sure, Jim. Thanks for having me, and happy 4th of July. It's shaping up to be a great day out there. I am a radiologist with a subspecialty in neuroradiology, currently practicing with Columbia Memorial Hospital. My wife and I have been here in Astoria as Astorians by choice for the last 7 years and absolutely love it here. Just to kind of bring you up to speed with how I came to be a radiologist, I have somewhat of a checkered past in my high school career.
Hey, me too.
Good. It's good to be around fellows of a similar ilk. In high school, I was in Evanston, Illinois, and very large high school. Kind of got lost in the shuffle and ended up dropping out of high school at the beginning of 11th grade. And searching around for myself in the mid-60s like a whole lot of other people were. And finally decided after 7 years of being out of school that I wanted to be a doctor for various reasons. However, I didn't have a high school diploma, so I had to get a GED. And I then applied to a couple of colleges, went to Marquette University, and finished in 3 years. I actually was so motivated to become a doctor that I never got anything but an A and ended up with a 4.0 average. But didn't get a degree. So I didn't have a high school degree. I didn't get a college degree. I was accepted into medical school after 3 years and went through in the usual 4 years of medical school at the Medical College of Wisconsin and got my MD degree. So my very first degree was my MD. And I decided I wanted to go into radiology. So that turned out to be a long haul. I did a one-year internship at LDS Hospital in Salt Lake City, and then 4 years of radiology at the University of Utah, and then a two-year neuroradiology fellowship at the University of Pennsylvania. That put me at about 1989, and I began in practice in L.A. Didn't like the L.A. area. I think I'm probably not alone in that. And decided to take a job in New Orleans, where we were up until Hurricane Katrina. Practiced in one of the oldest radiology groups in the country, serving the same hospital from 1927 until Hurricane Katrina, when, because all four of the hospitals closed that we were practicing in, our group disbanded. I was also a faculty member at Tulane University. And 1 month before Hurricane Katrina, I was made a full clinical professor of radiology, but didn't get a chance to do much with that since everything sort of shuttered up after Katrina. We then moved out here, and very fortunately, the hospital was looking for a radiologist at the time. And I filled the bill, and we got along great, And so we've been here since and have been absolutely perfectly happy here in Astoria, feeling very embraced by the community and in particular the medical community. It's a great place to live and work.
How did it come about that you focused on Astoria? How did you decide that this is where you wanted to live?
Well, it's interesting. When you're looking for a job, you have a you look for certain geographical areas where you'd like to be. My wife and I knew we both wanted to be on the coast, except we didn't know which coast. So we were looking at both coasts, and you can only get a job where there's a job available. And it turned out that when I was looking, serendipitously, a job became available here in Astoria. So the fellows here, the administration here, offered me the position of a radiologist. But at the same time, I was offered the same position for the hospital in Key West, Florida. So I was trying to decide which coast we wanted to be on, and unbeknownst to me, my wife was thinking, I never want to live in Hurricane Alley again on a little rock off the tip of Florida. She didn't tell me that, but eventually I came to see how much possibility there was here in Astoria, and independently made the decision. It turned out to be the right one for both of us.
Now, talk a little bit about the specialty that you practice, radiology, for our listeners. Describe what you actually do.
Sure. A radiologist, which is what I am, is a medical doctor who specializes in interpretation of images that are produced by all manner of imaging techniques, including MRI scans, CAT scans, nuclear medicine studies, ultrasound studies, and plain radiographs. When a physician, for example, one of the family practitioners here or an internist, thinks his patient may have pneumonia, for example, he may want to get a chest X-ray to see if there's something inside the chest that would corroborate his suspicion of pneumonia. So he'll do a chest X-ray, and then I'll be the one that looks at the picture that results from the chest X-ray and determine whether or not there is radiographic evidence of pneumonia. The same thing goes for when a physician wonders if his patient may have a brain tumor because he has seizure activity or has become forgetful. He may order an MRI scan of the brain. What I'll do is oversee the performance of that study, make sure that the study is done correctly to be able to answer the questions, make sure that the patient is safe during the course of the examination. And then once the examination is finished, I'll interpret the images and tell the referring clinician whether or not there's a brain tumor present. I'll answer his question specifically, but then I'll also look for any other abnormalities that may be present but unsuspected.
Now, MRI, that stands for magnetic resonance imaging?
That's correct.
Now, how does exactly that? I've had one recently. In fact, Bill read my scan. But I'd like to understand a little bit more about specifically how the thing works.
Sure. It's a way of creating an image of the inside of the human body utilizing a combination of a very strong magnetic field and radio waves as an energy source. It does not involve ionizing radiation, so it's very different than a CAT scan or a plain X-ray in that regard. What the patient experiences is being placed into the center of a very strong magnet that typically is anywhere from between 32,000 and 64,000 times the magnetic field strength of the Earth. When the patient is placed into that magnetic field, a certain population of protons, part of the water molecules inside the body, tend to align with the magnetic field. So we take advantage of that by perturbing the patient's body with radio frequency energy, not too different than the energy that's utilized for FM radio. And if we feed in energy at a particular frequency, some of the protons, which are aligned with the magnetic field, will absorb that energy and flip so that they're exactly aligned opposite to the direction of the magnetic field. Then when we turn off the radio frequency that's being fed into the patient's body and begin to listen, those protons which have flipped will flip back in alignment with the main magnetic field and emit a radio frequency exactly the same as what they have absorbed. And we can tell from that particular radio frequency where that proton is in the body and what its local environment is like. And with a very complex series of mathematical interpretations, high-powered computer stuff, we can create a map of the protons in the human body that create an image from which we can deduce what each area of protons in the body is experiencing.
Yeah, gotcha. That's pretty amazing. Now, getting back to New Orleans for just a minute, you were there during Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
And just briefly, I know there was an article in the New York Times written by ProPublica author Sherry Fink, mm-hmm. Shirley Fink, something like that. But anyway, they quoted you.
Mm-hmm.
As far as at Memorial, could you describe what that was about?
Sure. When Hurricane Katrina occurred, it was a Category 5 hurricane, which is the strongest hurricane in the Saffir-Simpson scale. as it was approaching New Orleans. And my wife and I happened to be at our farm 40 miles north of New Orleans, out of the zone of danger. Hmm. But like I always did whenever a hurricane approached New Orleans, instead of staying at the farm, I drove into New Orleans and went to the hospital so that I could be there to render care if care should be needed. It's kind of what most physicians did. They wanted to be on site to be able to help out if they could. So I went into the hospital, and on a Monday morning, the hurricane hit. And we didn't leave the hospital until Friday evening. The hospital had some 350 patients, including the largest population of neonatal intensive care unit patients in the city. We had about 27 neonates that were there when the hurricane hit. And in addition to the patients that were in the hospital, we also had patients' families that came to ride out the hurricane with their loved ones in the hospital, and the staff, and often their families as well, because the hospital was designated as a place of safety. So all told, we had between 2,500 and 3,000 people in the hospital that we were caring for during the height of the hurricane, but more importantly, during the aftermath when the levees had broken and the water began to rise.
Right, and at the hospital, the emergency generators were, for some reason, put in the basement, as I recall.
Actually, I'll tell you, it's even more complex than that. They were put on the second floor.
Okay.
And there was a line drawn between the top of the levee on the Mississippi River and the top of the levee on Lake Pontchartrain. And the generators were purposely put above that line. So if the levees ever overflowed and the basin, which forms the city of New Orleans, filled up to its capacity, the generators would be above that water line. However, right after the generator, the electric lines that should have gone out up from there actually went down to the basement.
Okay, that's right.
And that's where they were distributed. So the generators were okay, but the electric lines went down to the basement. And, of course, as soon as the flooding started to occur, the electricity went out for the whole structure. And we were basically stranded, surrounded by water, with no electricity and a lot of sick people.
Yeah, ugly story, actually. But let's get back to our local medical community and kind of describe the changes that you've seen in the 7 years that you've been here as far as the state of the art of our healthcare system.
Yeah, it's actually a very exciting and interesting story. As you and your listeners probably know, the medical community in Astoria was somewhat decimated in the late 80s by a lawsuit that culminated in a number of physicians leaving town.
Yeah, I was here at that time. Actually, that decision went all the way to the United States Supreme Court.
That's exactly right. And the suing physician actually won. And it was for that reason that a number of the physicians in town left, leaving Astoria with a very thin and a dispirited medical community. So at a time when Astoria economically was kind of on its heels, so was its medical community.
Right.
Now, fast forward to about 7-8 years ago, when I was invited to come here, the medical community had begun to make a turnaround. And I was fortunate to be in a place where changes were being made for the better, which included reinforcing of the medical staff locally, but also establishment of relationships with hospitals outside of the area to provide medical services that were not available here in town. The hospital made a very strong relationship with Legacy Emanuel for trauma care, which since we're the feeder hospital, if you will, for a population of 53,000 people living along this whole stretch of the coast. If you get into a bad car wreck, chances are you're going to be brought to Columbia Memorial Hospital, where if we can't take care of you there, you needed to be transported somewhere else. And the mechanism for transport to Legacy Emmanuel was put in place. And that hospital is a heck of a good hospital. For the longest time, it was the only designated level one trauma center in the Pacific Northwest, so designated by the American College of Surgeons. And they have excellent care there. So patients are a short helicopter ride away from Legacy. Also, since Astoria is really out on the coast and geographically somewhat isolated from the greater Portland area, if, for example, a patient is diagnosed with a dire disease such as a cancer, in the past, the patient would be relegated to having to travel back and forth to Portland 2 hours each way to receive chemotherapy or to receive radiation therapy once their cancer is diagnosed. So it's kind of a double whammy for them. In the past, they get the bad news of having a cancer, and then they have to endure the drive and the disruption of their lives in order to get that cancer treated. Well, shortly after I came, the hospital developed a relationship with OHSU, which is a nationally recognized cancer specialty center, the Knight Cancer Institute in particular, in order to provide locally medical oncologic services. What that means is that as of about 4 or 5 years ago, patients who had a cancer diagnosed here in Astoria might have to go somewhere else to have their definitive initial surgery, but then they could come back here to Astoria, live their lives with their family with a minimum of disruption, and receive their chemotherapy here. That's been in place and has been very successful now for, as I say, 4 to 5 years with the Oncologic Infusion Center at Columbia Memorial Hospital. And we have plans to begin to provide radiation oncology as well locally. Those are still in the formative stages, but I expect that our relationship with OHSU will branch out into that area probably in the next year or so.
Well, I need to remind our listeners that it's Friday here on Coast Community Radio, and we're visiting with Dr. Bill Armington, a local radiologist and world traveler. We'll get to that in a bit. But as far as the radiological treatment of some kind of a cancer, as a radiologist, is that something that you would do?
No, that's the purview of a radiation oncologist, which is a different branch of medicine.
Okay.
My specialty is to diagnose and to follow the progression of therapy with various radiologic studies, but not to actually treat the cancer.
Yeah, when we were talking before we went on the air, you were explaining to me how with the modern day communications that you're able to actually practice medicine in New Orleans mm-hmm. while living in Astoria.
Tell
me about that.
Sure.
Pretty interesting.
That's the beauty of broad bandwidth and a functionality in the radiology called a PACS system, which is picture archiving and communication system. In the old days, when we'd take an X-ray, it'd be shot on a piece of film. The technologist would go into a dark room and develop it and then bring it out to the radiologist, who would throw it up on a light box and try to make sense out of it. Nowadays, when we do radiologic studies, the images are captured digitally, and the image data is sent to the radiologist electronically, and we look at it on a computer workstation. Nice thing about that is I can be looking at images that were created here in Astoria, or I can be looking at images that were created in New Orleans. Time difference is exactly the same, and the picture quality is exactly the same. So when I couple that with a program for development of my report that employs voice recognition technology, for a patient in New Orleans who comes in to have their MRI scan done, I can look at their images, dictate a report, have that report transcribed immediately by the voice recognition technology, sign off on the report, and have that report appear in the patient's electronic medical record back in New Orleans, often before they even leave the scanner.
Wow.
And I can do that not just from here in Astoria, but from anywhere in the world. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to do that from a number of different locations in the world. And for me, personally, one of the most important things in my life is to feel that I'm contributing in a significant way to the welfare and well-being of patients that I care for. But I also want to be able to live my own life and see the world and see things that I think are important and enjoy my life with my family, because for one thing, there's an awful lot of interesting stuff going on in the world. And for another thing, life is very short.
Yes, don't remind me. Speaking of world travels, I know that you just got back from Tibet.
Yeah.
I wonder whether you could, and I've been reading about the political situation in that part of the world. It seems a little chaotic. Maybe you could kind of describe your impression of the Tibetan people and their interaction with the Chinese, and also some depredations apparently to the Sherpa community as well.
Sure. I'd be happy to do that. I've got to say that my wife and I have wanted to go to Tibet for a long time, but frankly, we've put off the trip because we did not want to support the Chinese government and what we perceive to be going on in Tibet by going there and acting as tourists and spending tourist dollars. However, things have become so much on an inexorable, non-reversible course in Tibet that because so much of the Tibetan culture is being lost, we thought it was best if we go now, because we may miss the culture if we wait much longer. So we decided to go to Tibet.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to get the appropriate visas and everything and went, just returning last week, actually. We were there for 2.5 weeks. We were traveling with 3 other folks, and we had a Tibetan guide who was born and raised in Lhasa, the largest city in Tibet, and an English guide who'd been guiding in Tibet and Nepal for some 25 years. So we had very experienced people to show us around. My initial impression, I expected Tibet to be a somewhat backward country, you know, kind of a rural with a few cities and ox carts and that sort of thing still making their way around. What has happened since the Chinese took over in 1959 and forced the Dalai Lama to leave Tibet, they have done what they're very good at, which is creating extremely good infrastructure.
Hmm.
This is really a tip of the hat to the Chinese in that regard. They've done that in other areas. They will build a city, and then because they have 1.3 billion people to distribute through incentives, then they'll populate the city. And that's exactly what's happened in Tibet. They've built Chinese infrastructure in Lhasa and the other two largest cities, so that if you look at the city walking down the street, you would think you were in a city in China.
Mm-hmm.
That's all very good, because there's running water and it's relatively clean and you can take buses and so forth. However, what they've done at the expense of the Tibetan people is to really gut the soul of the country by disincentivizing the continuation of the monastery system and the temple system. For example, there's a very large monastery that used to have some 6 colleges for learning about Tibetan Buddhism, 3,000 or 4,000 monks there. The number of monks is well below 500 now. Many empty rooms, and it's not the educational center it was anymore. But the Chinese have kept the exterior of the monasteries kind of like a Disneyland sort of enticement to get tourists to come. And the upshot is that the monasteries are still there and they're in good repair, but the soul of the monasteries have left. the monks are pretty much gone. And in fact, the ones that have remained are so dispirited. This is a little graphic, but in the last year, about 170 monks have set themselves on fire. It's called immolation, and it's a way of public protest. Interestingly, there are fire extinguishers around in the major squares of the major temples in case a monk should do that. The authorities, the Chinese, can put the fire out as quickly as they can. Very dispiriting.
Now, what do you suppose motivates the Chinese to do this to a separate culture? Is it just kind of a manifest destiny kind of thing?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. First of all, geographically, if you look at Tibet and its relationship to China, because of the position of the Himalaya, Tibet really appears to be part of China. And China has always thought of Tibet as an extension of China. China is a big country. Tibet is twice the size of France. China needs places to put all of their people. So annexation of Tibet was almost a foregone conclusion. And now they're building infrastructure so they can move Chinese nationals into the country. So they have space. They needed space. What they didn't want was political control of that area by the Dalai Lama, who was both the religious and the political leader of Tibet. And that's why they won't let him back in, because they want to have domination of Tibet and they want room for their people.
So it does sound to me kind of like manifest destiny, not dissimilar to the settlement of this country.
You know, I see that similarity. Very much so. We displaced the Native American population so that we could move in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of what's happening in Tibet with China.
What do you suppose the future holds for Tibet? Is the beautiful culture that the Tibetans epitomize, is that just going to go away?
You know, I don't think so. There's been a diaspora of the Tibetan people. There are huge expat Tibetan populations in Kathmandu on the west coast of the United States. And I think the spirit of Tibetan Buddhism within the Tibetan people will continue, just not in Tibet. But interestingly, Tibetan Buddhism as a religion has become very attractive to Chinese. And there are a number of Chinese individuals coming to Tibet to learn about Tibetan Buddhism, without the political implications of the Dalai Lama leading the country. So I think that Tibetan Buddhism will probably continue as a branch of Buddhism, but not in the form that it had been when it was both the political and the religious soul of the country of Tibet.
So the Chinese have come in and taken over the local government? Is that kind of what's happened?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
You can't go 5 miles on a major highway without running into a checkpoint. And you have to have papers showing that it's okay for you to travel the next 5 miles on that large highway. And in the cities, particularly around the temples, there are checkpoints where they'll run you through metal detectors and petroleum detectors to make sure you're not bringing something in that shouldn't be brought there.
Yeah.
Very tightly controlled.
You know, Bill, we've just got a couple of minutes left, so I wanted to kind of open the floor to you and see if there's anything that I've missed during this discussion.
Well, to get back to medical care here in Astoria, I'm very excited about the future of medicine in Astoria. Excited to both be a part of it and probably, since my wife and I plan on spending our remaining years here, being a recipient of it. So in a sense, what I've done here in the medical community is a selfish endeavor, because I expect that I'm going to be a patient at one time or another. So just to kind of wrap things up, Astoria is a fantastic place with all of the accoutrements of a small community that really allow personalities to blossom and flourish. Now with beginnings of a world-class medical care system, which I see in the future as making Astoria potentially a destination spot for receiving medical care. Let me put it a different way. If I were living in Portland and developed cancer, rather than fighting the traffic in Portland to get back and forth to my doctor's office, I would much rather come to Astoria, where I'd be receiving the same quality of medical care that I'd be getting in Portland without the hassle and with all the scenic beauty and warmth that a small town offers.
Well, we've been visiting this Friday with Dr. Bill Armington. Bill, I really appreciate you coming in. It's been fascinating to talk with you. I wish we had more time, but we don't.